Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, Christmas behind bars. The first pope to visit the inmates of a prison. And what the goddess Hunger and the Magnificat could possibly have in common. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As the Christmas tree is set up in St. Peter's Square, I'd like to turn my thoughts to those who cannot see this tree, not just because they're not here in Rome, but because they're locked up behind prison bars, in particular, behind prison bars in Ireland. Difficult to imagine what this festive season can be like for them, but what we can do is find out more about their daily lives. It's what Emma McCarthy did when she picked up the phone and spoke to the chaplain of Arbour Hill Prison in Dublin, Father Kieran Enright, asking him to share with us a behind-the-bars look at Christmas, beginning with Advent, the season of hope.
I suppose in many ways, actually, what I have found, because apart from being in Arbour Hill Prison, I was chaplain in Clover Hill Prison for a number of years as well, which is a remand prison where people have the added weight of waiting for their trial and waiting to find out what their sentence will be. And what I have found over the years is that I have drawn great strength and my own faith has been deepened by the ability of the men that I have kind of accompanied in prison, their ability to actually hold on to hope, their ability to hold on to faith. So many of these men have been through the most horrendous traumas in their lives, and I often think if I had a fraction of it in my life, I don't think I'd be able to cope. So their strength, their resilience, their ability to kind of to hold on to hope is what helps me. Now, having said that, obviously many men go through particular patches during a sentence where they really struggle to hold on to that hope. Quite a lot of depression and self-harming, of real kind of mental health struggles, and at times psychiatric struggles, emotional traumas, people who are experiencing bereavement and loss while they're there. And I suppose there's a sense in which, as a chaplain, you feel a great sense of powerlessness, of not being able to change the central place of pain, of loss, and that the only gift, possibly the most important gift, is to be able to be there with these men, to accompany them, to sit with them, to listen, to honour them as people, to see their dignity, to affirm their dignity on a daily basis, in ordinary everyday ways of calling them by name, of speaking with respect, of sharing humour, of sharing sadness, of meeting their families, these ordinary everyday ways. And then ultimately, I suppose what's important is also being able to share the word of God with them, and the hope of that word, to be able to celebrate the sacraments with them, to be able to have moments of prayer, of reflection, sacrament of reconciliation, services of remembrance, all of that. I suppose it's all part of the waiting in hope.
Where will you be celebrating Christmas, Father?
In the prison. I suppose I'm lucky in that I'd probably be able to double celebration. I'll be in the prison like right through the Christmas and the New Year, but I'm from Dublin myself, so what my family are around Dublin, I'd be able to celebrate with them in the evening as well. But I will be in the prison on Christmas Day, for example, up to about maybe 1:30, 1:30 before I go to family, and then back in the following day as well.
And how will you celebrate the Christmas in the prison? How do the inmates approach Christmas and how do they celebrate it?
Well, I suppose it's already in the sense that you'd have, over the last while, maybe people trying to make little pieces of craft work that they can send out to their families for Christmas, creating Christmas cards, preparing Christmas carols. We'll have an ecumenical Christmas carol service a week before Christmas. We'll have a reconciliation service, special family visits. You know, all those simple ways, but important ways. And then on Christmas Day, we'll have our Christmas Day Mass first thing in the morning. Then you do sense a great weight, actually, in the prison. Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, there's a very palpable sense of, I suppose, suppose, of sadness and loss. So many men have very mixed memories of Christmas growing up. Those who are fathers of children, obviously kind of missing their children at Christmas time. And so that there can be that mixed feeling. But also what you'll notice at Christmas is people trying to boost each other up, trying to help each other through it, and wanting it to be over, really, to be honest with you.
Would it make any difference if the extended community around Arbor Hill remembered that there's also a community that isn't as free to celebrate Christmas in the way it wanted to? Do you think that society just forgets about the prisoners once the keeping
going? I have to say, in fairness, they don't. I mean, my experience is, like, for example, we've a group of lads come in every Sunday to play a game of football. Do you know what I mean? Young men in their 30s and 40s, all working, who could easily kind of just be sleeping on Sunday, but they come in religiously every Sunday to have a game of football. Another team comes in another day of the week. You'll regularly have choirs kind of expressing their willingness to come in and join us for some singing. Do you know what I mean? So I think they're, in fairness, another group, like you'd have the Guild of St. Philip from the Vince de Paul, who come in every Saturday. People who ring, who say that they'd like to kind of maybe befriend someone who has no family to visit. So I think, in fairness to kind of society and communities, there is actually a sense of empathy and compassion within people's hearts and minds that isn't always reflected in general opinion or doesn't always land in print from the media. But there is, like, I've always found that over the years, like, particularly coming up to Christmas, different groups and individuals wanting to kind of reach in.
They're not forgotten.
Not forgotten, no, not forgotten. And it's always appreciated. The men really, really appreciate, like, they would never take for granted, say, for example, that football team that come in. They really, really appreciate that, because apart from the game of football, there's a statement that's being made that's kind of saying, you are of value, you are not forgotten, you are not alone.
And a big thank you there to Father Kieran Enright, chaplain of Arbor Hill Prison in Dublin, and of course to my colleague Emma McCarthy. And now, moving on in the programme, why not take a look at the first visit of a Roman pontiff to the inmates of a prison, setting the trail for the popes who came after him, including our present Pope Benedict XVI. The pope in question is one gone down in history as the ordinary man who astonished the world for having called the Second Vatican Council, but he was more popularly known as Good Pope John, for it was not just prisoners he visited at Christmas and at other times in the year, but children in hospital as well, overall inventing a new style of papacy. Stay tuned then as I step back in time for this very personal feature based on sound from our very own archives, focusing on this 20th century Pope. The story begins as he travels down the road from the Vatican to the Regina Caeli prison. Prisoners cheering, drowning out the voice of Pope John XXIII as he speaks to them behind the bars of a Roman prison. It was Christmas 1958, and in an unprecedented gesture, a pope was standing in their midst offering them words of comfort. "When you write home," he said, "be sure to tell your families the pope has been to see you."
La prima lettera che scrivete adesso a casa vostra deve portare la notizia che il Papa è venuto in mezzo a voi e che vi promette, anche lui dice il suo rosario e quindi fa passare a vendere i grani della sua corona, dice la sua messa, che si impegna.
You could come to see me, so I came to see you. It wasn't just going to the prison, which was a first, but it was his manner in the prison, the way he greeted the prisoners, and in his talk right away he said, "Listen, I know it's tough. In my own family, one of my cousins ended up here too."
At the time, the late Father Redemptus Vallerbeck was a young Carmelite seminarian in Rome. He recalled the enormous impact of John XXIII's visit to the prison.
So right away, there was that personal touch with the prisoners. You could see some of them in the pictures, you know, crying that that the Pope would come to see them, which had never happened before.
Nobody had ever gone to the prisons. like that on Christmas Day. I mean, he thought of, you know, the little ones in hospital and the people in prison. He didn't respect the protocol. I mean, he went straight at it. If he wanted to talk to somebody, he would talk to them.
When the Pope visited the Bambin Gesù Children's Hospital, Jill Tyler was a young journalist in Rome, reporting for the most popular British Catholic newspaper.
There were no sort of comments about the political ways of doing things or anything like that. It was just that he went to the people.
Io sono venuto qui, come vedete, in perfetta condizione di salute. Non proprio pronto a fare una corsa, entrare in una gara, ma insomma però per misurarli con la comune, ecco.
Suddenly you had this Pope who acted out of instinct, who said what was on his mind, who responded to people. I mean, they say the first time he went to a hospital, Bambino Gesù here in Rome, the children all started screaming, Pope, come here, Pope, come here, Papa, vieni, vieni, you know, come here. And he said, okay, the Pope is coming, the Pope is coming, I'm coming to see you. It was a natural instinct on his part. And it was so astounding. You might say, to some degree, that he restored some of the pastoral dimensions of the papacy.
Historian Father Paul Robichaud of the Paulist Order grew up in the United States during John XXIII's pontificate.
They must go back to your childhood almost, I think, John XXIII.
Well, I was in grade school when Pope John XXIII became Pope in 1958. I was just 10 years old. And a few recollections, because television was something very new in my family. And so the idea that you could actually see something about the election of a pope on television, and that the warmth that this pope exuded, what came with that warmth were all of this great excitement about the church, and that things were somehow changing in the church. And so during the years of his pontificate period, where I was going from the age of 10 to the age of 15, going through adolescence, rebellion, and so I'm sure to some degree that the changes that the church brought about by the calling of the Vatican Council probably were reflective of some of my feelings at the time and made the church more interesting and exciting. But I think more importantly was this incredible sense of his warmth and his presence, how it seemed to be impacting on my parish, my school, the parochial life that surrounded me, and how things seemed to be less rigid, much more warm and personal and engaging. And so the very personality of the Pope seemed to come all the way down to my local parish somewhere and express itself in a lot of warmth and care.
Della luce va bisogna portarla in santa pazienza, in pazienza, un esercizio. E poi, precisamente, lo spettacolo, spettacolo della carità.
When we saw the Pope, and we saw him really as friendly, as simple, may be a misleading word, because he was a very intelligent person, and he was much deeper than people thought.
Nigerian-born Cardinal Francis Arinze was in Rome studying for the priesthood at the time. He felt Papa Roncalli played a key role in giving life to the missionary church.
When he visited our college in Propaganda, as we were then urban, Collegio Urbano di Propaganda Fide, I remember a phrase he used, our two hills look at one another and understand each other. That is the Vatican Hill and the Janiculum Hill, because Collegio Urbano is on the other hill, immediately overlooking the Vatican. So we liked him. And it was in his pontificate then we were ordained priests. He loved the mission church. And he showed it by the way he treated the mission college, by the way he treated the mission bishops. Indeed, from that time, the number named bishops in the mission countries increased at a very fast rate.
The first thing he did is he suddenly empowered a whole new generation of church leaders. He created, in a series of four consistories, a whole new college of cardinals. He invited the bishops of the world to come to Rome for an ecumenical council. And where originally the Curia controlled the original agenda for the council, and that turned around, he eventually empowered all of these bishops to move. So one of the things that's very interesting is, even though he appears non-collegial, or someone who's very decisive and single-minded in what he did, he was the great facilitator.
Pope John the 23rd was very far-seeing, and we also admired his openness to other Christians. I think once he gave a ring to an Anglican, that was, for us, it was most symbolic. It was almost revolutionary. So that was a very eloquent act. It meant taking them seriously as our fellow Christians with whom we want to prepare for that day when we will be reunited, as Christ didn't want two churches or three or four or 500, but just one. The fact that when he died, everybody agreed that this was a great saint, that this was a great pope and a saint. Even the communists would be in favor that he should be canonized, so which is very good. And the other Christians would be in favor too.
One of the things he said when he was dying was that there's not a person that I met in my life that I didn't love. He was a very positive person who could find the good in people, even good in people who you would traditionally consider your enemies or on the other side of the fence. So he fit in with the spirit of the times very well. Remember his Pacem in Terris, Peace on Earth, his very famous encyclical letter, which again made a big splash. I mean, the New York Times, which was not known to be very favorable to the papacy, carried article on article about this really groundbreaking document. But I mean, that's just one instance. All over the world, even I remember the communists in Moscow reacted to it, which was, flabbergasting. We couldn't believe it, that there would be some reaction. In fact, they came to call the peace priest movements in the satellite countries Pacem in Terris. Those priests who were collaborating with the communist regimes, they called them Pacem in Terris, commemorating the encyclical of Pope John the 23rd. It was a very broad encyclical, how we should foster peace on earth. And it was broad enough to include many things, and I think everyone could resonate with the basic premise that he had at the beginning, that if you want peace in the world, it has to begin with peace in your heart. Peace in the heart of every individual. And I think that resonates with many people, not just Catholics or Christians or even religiously oriented people. That's why I do think that he hit at certain basic truths that many people could agree with, even if they weren't particularly religious. I think that's what made him so popular.
A fare speciali intenzioni per ciascuno di loro.
I hope you enjoyed this program put together with sound from Vatican Radio archives and from my very own personal archives here. Finally, I'd like to end today's broadcast on a totally different note by joining our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Do watch change of pace and tone.
I'm going to use the expression Temple of Fame today. Just listen carefully to what I'm going to say. I think you will certainly have a niche in the Temple of Fame, meaning your achievements will cause people to honour you and keep your memory green.
Who said that?
I did.
Wow, okay. No. Angulum in templo fame habes. It est opera tua, bene efficient te o ut honorent, and keep your...
keep your memory green?
Eh, tuique viridem conservant memoriam.
Somehow I don't think we'll need to keep your memory green, Father. You're larger than life. How do you say that, larger than life?
Vita ipsa maior.
Today I'm going to be full of non sequiturs, or anyway, I want to pick up on the word fame. There's a popular saying which goes, familiarity breeds contempt.
Yeah. Well, it's the Romans had. Well, you could say contemptum dignit familiaritas.
Point of fact, I really meant at a higher level, like a prophet not appreciated in his own country.
Ah, that's another famous one. That's, of course, the words of Jesus of Nazareth. Propheta non acceptus in patria sua.
The word familiar in Latin is linked to the word fabulus, meaning servant, no?
Yes, and so familia, where? And familia, see, that's where they came from. And the familia was the group of household servants. That's familia. Was the household, the group of household servants. And then from there you get the whole family, but the first meaning of familia are the household servants. That's why Cicero wrote, he was down in Formia, and wrote to his wife up here in Rome and says, you can bring the familiam, bring the servants of the house down to Formia. You see, and then it kind of went over to mean the whole household, but it really, you're right. When you say famulus is a servant and familia is the group of household servants.
Now I want to quote from Shakespeare, taking things a little out of context.
Oh.
In Henry V, we read, quote, away with him, he has a familiar under his tongue and a spirit slave, sometimes in human shape, unquote.
A familiar.
Yes.
Under his tongue.
And then Shakespeare adds that this familiar sometimes appears as a cat, a dog, or a raven. In other words, a demon in disguise. How would you translate a spirit slave or demon in disguise?
Daemonem is a demon. And it's a spiritum, if you wish, in disguise, in simulacro, like a statue in a different figure, simulacro. Habet sub lingua, under his tongue, whatever that means. I use Shakespeare all the time. Oh, I adore Shakespeare.
Did the slaves of the Fabulus believe in demons and spirits at all?
Well, maybe as popular, you know, superstition. I think they did. Yeah, like people today. No, it doesn't change. The more intellectual people would say, well, that's a nice idea, but, you know.
You know, one of the reasons I started speaking about the word fame is that one of my former colleagues, her name is Michelle, consulted you as regards the goddess of hunger, known as Fames. That word Fames made me think of fame.
Fames, yeah, is hunger, and fama is fame. So you have to be kind of careful what you're saying. And so that's why someone at the house said recently, habes magnam famem. I said, well, I'm really not hungry now. I said, maybe it's magnam famam, which is a great fame, but not hunger. Anyway.
So what about this goddess of hunger? Who was she?
I told Michelle, I don't think really she was considered a goddess.
All I found was that according to Virgil, Famis lived underground.
Well, yeah, that's the underworld.
Huddled next to the personification of poverty.
Exactly, prosopopoeia. Exactly, that was taken from Virgil in the 6th book, where he goes down to hell and he sees all these people sitting there at the beginning entrance of hell. And there are about 10 of them, you know, of evil things in the world. And hunger's one of them. That's where he gets this from.
And he goes on to say, quote, ever hungry, always weak and empty. Famis is unable to provide spiritual nourishment.
No one ever said that.
It's invented.
But the fact is, I gave Michelle a whole list of adjectives. She said, well, what did Famis say? Look at the adjectives. She's severe and she's sterile and she's drawn and she's weak. And I said, look at all the adjectives that the Roman authors attributed to hunger, like a woman, about how they never described her, whether she had long hair or short hair, etc. That they didn't do.
How do you say starving?
Famelicus. Famelicus is one who's very hungry. Azuriens is someone who's hungry. Azuriens.
Did the Romans ever speak of anorexia or bulimia? Did they have words for these concepts?
I don't think so, no. No. The way we understand today, to kill yourself to stay thin, I don't think so. They had other things, you know. They used to paint their faces and their hands with white plaster. The trick there to be beautiful is the whiter you get was beautiful, more beautiful. And so you have these people come out looking like plaster, white plaster statues.
They covered themselves in flour or what?
They had different pigments and flour and stuff. Because they say the whiter the better, not the thinner the better. Crazy.
So sunbathing was a no-no.
Well, no. It wasn't brownish. It was apricazio. Apricazio, apricots. You guys say apricots. Is this fruit that lies in the sun? You don't know that. You did know that.
How'd you say suntan?
Okay, apricor is to lie in the sun. So apricatio is lying in the sun.
I'd like to end now by quoting from a compatriot of yours, Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Ooh!
Is he from your part of the world?
I think so.
Anyway, he once wrote, "Hungry as a chap who said a turkey was too much for one, not enough for two."
As a chap, a guy, a person. Isuriens ut sodalis. As a chap, what do you say? Cui gallus indicus uni redundat is too much. Uh-huh. Et parum duobus.
Another expression we have in England is hungry as a grave.
Never heard of hungry as a grave. That's awful, too. Famelicus est ut sepulchrum. He is as hungry as tumulus, as a grave, I don't know, whatever that means.
One last word, for real this time. The hungry 40s in Britain, meaning the widespread distress among the poor at the time.
The hungry 40s, yeah. Quadragesimi anni esurientes. Esurientes quadragesimi anni. The 40-ish years hungry. By the way, this occurs in liturgical. Esurientes. It's the Magnificat. Esurientes implebit bonis. I was listening to Bach this morning. He will fill the hungry with good things. In Mary's Magnificat. And Esurientes is in there. In the Vulgate, he will fill the ones hungry with good things.
Bach.
Ooh, this morning his Magnificat. Ooh! Absolutely heavenly. And there is Bach. Johannes John Sebastian Bach. No, Esurientes implebit bonis. He will fill the ones hungry with good things, which is in the mouth of Mary in her Magnificat.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, currently teaching in the United States, but one who spent almost all of his life as papal Latinist. And that brings me up to time. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. Laudetur Jesus Christus.